podcast for the course. This is on the question concerning technology by Martin Heidegger. The translation that I'll be using for this podcast is the one done by William Lovett. It's put out by HarperCollins. This is the oldest version. I think it's the most predominant version used in English, perhaps the only one. We'll begin right at the beginning here of the essay. What I'll do here is first go through what Heidegger sees as the modern situation, the one that it gives rise to this essay and to the very question concerning technology that is going to provide sort of the framework for what he is doing here. Then secondly, I'll turn to what he believes technology is in its essence, what the link between the essence of technology is and technology itself. And this will require, thirdly, a turn to the Greek notion of techne, at least as Heidegger describes it, and its relationship between this know-how that is referenced by the word techne in Greek. That's probably the best way to translate it, a know-how. Heidegger will have his own translations, which I'll go through. And the Greek thinking, again, as Heidegger puts it, of technology. Okay, and how that is different from the modern technology that gives rise to these questions. As Lovett notes in the preface to the book, the lecture that we have before us was first given, at least in some version, in 1949 at the Club for Bremen, and then again in 1955 November 18, 1955, in the present version. There's a series of lectures entitled The Arts in the Technological Age. Some of these other texts that he gave as part of those lectures were translated. As listeners to this podcast will know, no doubt by the time that you come to this, Heidegger, after World War II, was able to lecture in the German universities due to the denazification program and his alignment with the Nazis in 1933 to 34. So because of that, he was unable to lecture for some years after World War II. And so he lectured to various groups. He was perhaps the most famous philosopher working in Germany, and certainly was somebody that they wanted to hear, not least because Heidegger's work was being translated widely. It was also being introduced to the general public through the existentialists of France and through others as well. So by this time, Heidegger is sort of the godfather of major movements in intellectual history underway some years earlier. And so people are willing and wanting to hear from him. So he gives this one of these lectures is going to be about technology. And so timing is perspicuous. We tend to think of technology as being a good in itself. That is to say that it goes unquestioned. I'm, in fact, giving this podcast, and this, which will be turned into a bit of a movie. So you might have either version, through a piece of technology, and we think this is progress, right? Indeed, you'll say, well, in the bad old days, we just had lectures to go to. Now, depending on your point of view, this is either better or worse. Now you also have a podcast which augments and supplements what you get in the lecture course, and this is automatically good. Now, somebody uses this technology, I think it is good, but it just simply goes unquestioned. In other words, when a new piece of podcasting software or an iPod comes out or whatever you're listening onto this on, you will automatically buy it almost without question. That is to say, you might ask yourself, well, how much did it cost and so on. But that's really a very technological question, right? You're asking whether it's efficient. Am I getting my value for my money? And so these questions about efficiency almost override any other value in the contemporary age. And this question comes back to us through technology in particularly harsh ways. That is to say, if it can be done more quickly and with lower cost, no matter what the means are, it's worth it. Now you might ask, well, what is really the danger of this? Well, it's dangerous when we start to begin to think of other living beings and the environment itself as simply what Heidegger calls a standing reserve. Now, Immanuel Kant, in the 18th century, had earlier argued that no ethics could be founded upon using other human beings as a means, that each of us is to be recognized in terms of our inherent dignity as reasoning beings, and therefore should never be used as tools or never be used as means towards an end. And he builds his ethical system around that. Heidegger, writing after World War II, has seen all that the Enlightenment era, of which Kant is a representative, has given us. That is to say, our belief in progress, our belief in the power of technology, and our belief, almost unquestioned for a long time, Kant is not necessarily a representative of this, but in any case, for a long time, Enlightenment thinking had lent credence to the view that each generation was going to be better off than the last. World War I, and then following up on it rather quickly in historical terms, World War II, puts the lie to that faith, puts the lie to the argument that one generation will have it better than the last. And Heidegger's question in the question concerning technology is actually to ask about his own historic, the importance of his own historic intervention here. That is to say that he recognizes that in previous epochs, it would not have occurred to anybody to question concerning technology. That is to say, we might question about whether we should be using different types of labor, whether we should be using less child labor, whether we should be instead educating children in order to get better efficiency out of the labor force later on. These are the type of questions you might get in the 19th century. In the 20th century, there's a real question concerning technology, and that's very different. Question concerning technology as such. And so it's not a question about this or that technology, but a question concerning technology as such. And so it's a very different question. Heidegger recognizes that, obviously, in light of the mass devastation caused by different armaments, nuclear and otherwise, the masses of dead, we cannot even begin to wrap our minds, not only around the Nazi final solution, not only around the Eastern Front in World War II and the Western Front as well. We just cannot map our mind around really the industrial mass killing that was witnessed in the years prior to Heidegger giving this seminar. We have the industrialized factories of death in the concentration camps. We have the various factories of death that gave us the arms necessary to cause the other deaths in those wars. And this is inescapable. We're also quite aware of the use of technology to end all life as we know it. This is he's writing in the beginning of the nuclear age. We also recognize that this is not a problem that will go away. We know very well, they were aware of it then, that the nuclear bomb, once exploded, had unleashed something upon the world that could never be taken back. And that the wars we had seen had unleashed something upon the world that could never be taken back. So it's a real concern, a real question concerning technology. So what this should suggest to you from the very beginning, in any case, is that this is not going to be a critique of technology. Okay? This is not going to be a critique of technology. Why? Because Heidegger argues that the critiques of technology that one finds when he is writing, and I think that's even more true today, take place within what we could just simply call, and a reminder for any Heidegger scholars or anyone else who comes upon this is a pedagogical tool. There will be a lot of simplification. Send me an email if you find it's oversimplifying, but just provide me better examples. So, in any case, the point is to ask after why Heidegger is raising this question. And the question concerning technology does not have to do with technology as such. He's very quick to say in the first pages of the essay that it's a question concerning the essence of technology. The ideology underpinning technology is one of efficiency and progress. Okay? If you look at any political articles, articles over Social Security, articles over healthcare debates, articles over what is to be done ethically, in all types of things, it is almost somebody could say this is more efficient, and that ends the argument. That ends the argument now. And this wasn't always the case. And as Heidegger is at pains to point out, but I think others have pointed out even better, this is a modern worldview. This is a modern ideology. Now, Heidegger's claim is going to be that this ideology didn't come out of nowhere, that this Gestell, this enframing, as he calls it, one that infuses all of our thinking, is given rise to by the Greeks. Now, whatever romanticism Heidegger will have of the Greeks, and he certainly will have a certain romanticism about them, it's certainly true that the roots of modern technicity, of modern technology, is given rise to in the classical age. That is, the Greeks not only provide a counter-thinking to contemporary uses and abuses of technology, but also a counter-thinking, but also they gave rise to it, they gave birth to it. So without the Greeks, there is no modern conception of technology. We can put aside now the question, the whole question of Eurocentrism. This is a history of Europe by a European, and certainly he thinks the Greeks are at the center of any good thinking that we should return to. The essay is about the question concerning technology. For readers of Heidegger, you will recognize that throughout his writings, including famously the Introduction to Being in Time, there, in each of his writings, he is formulating a question. For Heidegger, in many senses, one could say that all of his writing is looking to formulate a question well, rather than answering any predetermined questions given to us by the, bequeathed to us by the tradition. In some sense, what he's always trying to do is formulate another way of asking a question so as to raise, perhaps, a different set of answers. Or, not to sound too Zen-like or New Agey, the question itself is the very path that we want to undertake. So, the question of being is raised in Being in Time, and that, Heidegger stipulates, is the way or a path that one undertakes towards recovering or deconcealing that which has been thrust into oblivion or forgetfulness, that is, the very question of what is. By the time he's writing in the question concerning technology, in some sense he's a bit more concrete. I don't think you can get more concrete than one's actual being, but I think certainly for conversations with your friends and so on, this will seem like a more concrete discussion. That is to say, technology as such has given us a particular relation to being that we no longer ask that question. All of our question is reduced to one particular type of being, the efficient type of being. That is, what is most valuable in terms of a means and distinction. So Heidegger writes at the very beginning, "In what follows we shall be questioning concerning technology. Questioning," he says, "builds a way. We would be advised, therefore, above all, to pay heed to the way and not to fix our attention on isolated sentences and topics. The way is a way of thinking. All ways of thinking more or less perceptibly lead through language in a matter that is extraordinary." Let's pause there. You're recognizing very quickly that Heidegger's the question concerning technology, like all of his later writings, and his early writings too, has an abundance of Heideggerese. A very, sometimes abstruse language. But what Heidegger is trying to do is this: is that if we try to think of beings as not simply something known, but also something preconceptual, that is, we have a relationship to being that is not just about knowing objects external to us, then he has to figure out a way to articulate that without using all the language of knowing. Because for Heidegger, one of the parts of what he's going to call the enframing or the Gestell, one of the crucial parts of it, is a split between the person who sees, normally called this in the modern age called the subject, and that which is seen, namely the object. And that which is the object is taken to be a resource, or something standing over and against that person who sees, or the subject. And it's that split between the two that he thinks is very much foreign to the Greek conception of technology. And it's certainly one that he is arguing has led us towards a particular way of asking questions. We ask, what is that object? And we pretend that we are objectively standing off from that object in sort of a philosophical gaze, like journalists who are providing a narrative account of being without ourselves being taken up in that being, without ourselves being taken up in that existence we are describing. This is what he calls the scientific worldview. Now, what I'll say time and again is that Heidegger is not necessarily anti-technological. He is not precisely anti-scientific. What he's trying to point out in the best Heidegger is the limits of that type of thinking. This is why I underline here in the first phrases, that the way is a way of thinking. There are certainly places, perhaps not in Heidegger, but one that he can't dispose of, certainly is a place for rational thinking. There's a place for what we call calculative thinking, what we would also call scientific thinking. This is the type of thinking that works with representative models, representative theories, with certain calculation and so on. Look, when we need accounting done, when we need medicine, when we need physics, when we need various technologies produced, these are particularly good modes for doing so. The problem that Heidegger is going to attempt to identify is that we've reduced all thinking to these two types of thinking. And you might get lost in all the types of thinking. So we might begin by asking ourselves, is this essay itself a practice in another type of thinking other than calculative or representative? Okay. Secondly, the questioning produces a way. As I suggested earlier, this questioning itself is the way. And this is exactly what he says. It pays heed to the way. And what he's saying, we should be advised, therefore, above all, to pay heed to the way, not to fix our attention on isolated sentences and topics. What he's saying there is, in some sense, we are producing a way. The example of technology itself is incidental. Second thing. It's not so incidental. It's what gives rise to the question. So there is a real, what we could just simply call an existential weight to this question. It's one that has a weight for all of us. We have technology, or what we would call technology, all around us, whether it's your computer, it's your podcast. Even a book is a form of technology, or the light around you is a form of technology. Anything, quote-unquote, artificial. Now, Heidegger is going to disrupt that whole idea that technologies as such is artificial, but we'll come back to that. For now, it's just important to quote here. This is included in the introduction nicely. This is from On the Way to Language, where Heidegger writes, "At the close of a lecture called The Question Concerning Technology, given some time ago, I said," and this is on page 28 of the introduction, "I said, questioning is the piety of thinking. Piety is meant here in the ancient sense, obedient or submissive, and in this case, submitting to what thinking has to think about." Obviously, what thinking he is thinking about here in this context is technology, or what I'll use the word technicity. I'll talk about why that term is chosen. Submitting to what thinking has to thought. So thinking is not about mastering the outside. That is a subject who has to master concepts, a subject who has to master a set of knowledge, who has to master, for example, the essay concerning the question concerning technology essay. We tend to think of thinking as mastery, as domination over the outside world. In other words, we tend to think of it as a very technological way. One of the exciting experiences, he writes, this is on page 29, of thinking, is that at times it does not fully comprehend the new insights it has just gained and does not properly see through them. So, too, is the case with the sentence just cited, that questioning is the piety of thinking. The lecture ending with that sentence was already in the ambiance of the realization that the true stance of thinking cannot be to put questions, but must listen to that which our questioning vouchsafes, and all questioning begins to be a questioning only in virtue pursuing its quest for essential being. Now, what this means is that thinking itself is not reducible or not collapsible to either thinking as calculating. Think of people often picture the brain as one giant computer and with one giant calculating machine, or thinking as simply representative pictures. So we have pictures in flesh and mind, and the whole point is to get those pictures right. And Heidegger's thinking of a thinking that is led along by questioning in order to build a path towards what is essential. Or as he'll put elsewhere, what holds sway. another way of saying is, what is meaningful to us, even if it is not a matter of knowledge, but what helps build the experience of the world in which we're in? Okay? For us in the modern age, we cannot escape the fact that it is technology, and in a particular type of technology that in some sense has gone off the rails from its very beginnings in the Greek notion of techne. Now here on pages 3 to 4, Heidegger notes that he is not going to be asking after technology as such, but that he's going to be talking about the essence of technology. Now normally understood in the tradition, this technology, or he's using the German word Technik, that is to say a technicity, that which makes technology it's as such. Techniques would be another way to translate it. Strategies that one uses. There's various ways to translate that. So it's not technology as such, but tools or techniques or strategies or anything that goes beyond what you consider your rather limited means, right? So you have a technique for listening to this podcast, or you might have a technology or technique for listening, for watching TV, or you might, and this could be something that's both concrete and an object of technology, an iPod, or it can be just simply a method, in any event. So that's why we use technicity. What makes a technology? This gets us back to what he calls the essence of technology, namely the German word Wesen. Now, Heidegger elsewhere translates the Wesen as a way. And what he's trying to get away from is the old notion of essence. That is to say that we say the essence of a chair is that which is shared out by all chairs and is knowable and representable in the mind. Now, Heidegger is going to move us away from that towards a thinking of how the chair operates. And even that's a bit clunky. That is to say, what is the how of the chair? What way does it open up for us in our relationship to it? That's much more of a crucial question, because that's really the essence of a chair. Right? The essence of a chair isn't something that you know. Right? You don't sit in what you know, even if it's a set of facts about the chair. No. It is about its how, its way with you. Right? And this is all pre-conceptual for Heidegger, going back to his early work in Being and Time. Right? We drive a car, we have a way with it, we drive from point A to point B without even really thinking about our driving, without calling to mind representations of the car, without calling to mind certain sets of facts. No, the car is unveiled to us, revealed to us. This is what Heidegger calls aletheia, or truth, right? In a way that it doesn't have to be conscious thought, it doesn't have to be representative thinking, it doesn't have to be calculating thinking, but still we're able to drive the car. We're still able to have a way in the world with that car, and it opens up a world for us. It opens up a particular set of experiences. It opens up another way or relationship to the world. This is crucial to understand, because Heidegger is not after a set of knowledge and facts about technology, but what is the way that is open to us with the particular type of technology that we have today? Because it's going to be very different from the way in which the world is opened up to us, to the technologies that he's going to reference come to us from the Greek times. Pottery, cobbling, that is to say shoes, walking sticks. These type of things are very different in kind, and certainly you recognize it as such from the later technologies like bombs, weapons, airplanes, and so on. Right? These are very different. Not simply because they have different effects and larger effects. They're not just simply bigger or more powerful. They're different in kind. They're qualitatively different, as we would say in philosophy. They're qualitatively different. They have the same root, the same type of thinking, but they're going to be very different. So Heidegger begins on pages 4 to about the next text pages, about page 14 or so, to think about technology beyond its well-known definition. That is, we tend to think of technology as simply instrumental. Human beings use technology. And so we see that we call technology an iPod, which is an instrument for using for listening to music. We use a cup as a technology for drinking water. We use a book as a technology for reproducing the written word, right, and for reading it. So we have a particular type of technology called the codex. That's the books we use. And we read from them, right? We read the questions concerning technology. We use lights as an instrument for reading and for light. And he's going to say, what, though, is the root of this type of thinking of technology as an instrument? Well, we see technology as a means to an end. Okay? And it's a mastery. We master over nature or something to bring it under human control. Okay? So Heidegger is going to go from technicity to the essence of technology to the difference between the means and end. Okay? This is very prevalent in all kinds of modern thinking, especially Kantian ontology and ethics, the difference between a means and an end, to its root in the notion of a cause, and then he's going to go back to Aristotle's famous four causes. Then he's going to talk about the aition, that is the Greek word for cause, right, which also means responsibility for. And then he's going to talk about the way that these four approaches of Aristotle, that is the four types of causes, allow what he calls a presencing. And then he talks about aletheia, the Greek aletheia, as revealing. And in that way, he's going to sort of structure his essay. He's going to move technology all the way back to this aletheia as revealing and talk about techne as being a mode of revealing. Okay. So what's going on page 6 to 7 is a discussion of the four causes, about causality. And so for centuries, he writes, this is on page 6, philosophy has taught that there are four causes. This is a material cause, causa materialis. Secondly, the causa formalis, that is to say, the formal cause. Right, so the material cause is obviously, he uses the example of the silver chalice here. The chalice is made up of silver. The formal cause is, what is its shape? Then he causes the causa finalis, that is the final cause, the teleological cause. What is it being used for? Here, the silver chalice is being used for sacrifices, for sacrificial rites. Not sacrifice in the truly awful sense that it's normally taken to be. And then the causa efficiens, that is to say, the efficient cause. That is to say, who brings it about? And we normally just think of the silversmith as the efficient cause. Now, as Heidegger notes, these four causes have been reduced basically to the efficient cause. And certainly one way of thinking about these four causes as a whole, what brings something about? Well, all four causes. That is to say, if it wasn't for what one wanted to bring about, namely the final cause, if one didn't have the material, if one didn't have the shape in mind, and if one didn't have the hand worker who put together the silver chalice, one would not have be able to efficiently bring in, that is to say, immediately cause to bring about this piece of technology. So all of these are in some sense reducible to the efficient cause. And so we've talked about causality endlessly with regard to technology. What's going to be interesting, though, is that Heidegger wants us to understand that when something is brought about in the world, whether it's a chair, it really upsets the world as we've previously thought about it. And I think this is what he's getting at when he says everything's been reduced to efficient cause, but it hasn't quite been understood the way in which this causality goes back and forth. That's why Heidegger, this discussion can seem opaque, and it certainly did to me the first time that I read this. And I said, well, what is this the whole discussion of responsibility for that he gets to on 8 and 9? Why does he talk about the Greek root of the word aition, A-I-T-I-O-N, at least in the Roman letters that we use? Why does he look to this? Why does he talk about responsibility? Well, what he's saying is there's a way in which we, as the producer, are responding to that which is in front of us. In the double sense, obviously there's the notion of ethical responsibility. Heidegger's not going there. He's just saying that the Greek word, he's just noting that the Greek word aition is not just the word for cause, but it's also a word used often in courts and so on. Who is at fault? Who is being brought up on charges here? What is the charge? The Greeks would use the word aitheon for that as well. And so he says there's a real responsibility for an object, a real responding to an object, such that it changes you. What does this mean? Very simply, your experiences are very different after producing an iPod. Your world changes. We see that. The human world is very different after technology, after certain technologies, than before them. It's a real event when these come about. It's an event when the atom bomb is exploded. It has a reverberating effect that it sets that whole order of cause and effect. We are affected by it too. So we tend to, by putting the efficient cause all in the human being, we seem to make the human being into a master over technology, even though we are very much changed by that technology. We are changed by that relationship. So that's what Heidegger is critiquing, that as soon as that starts to get underway, that type of thinking, Heidegger is going to try and hold it at bay. He's going to say, see, that's where the problem begins. We begin to think of human beings as a maker, as separate, as being a master, right? We talk about the artist being a genius and so on. And we rip people out of history. We say that the artist is a genius and therefore not affected by the course of other events. And Heidegger is going to take real exception to that, because by separating us out and from this responsibility, this responding to that which is produced, we take ourselves out of the way, we take ourselves out of the experience of that. Now, moving relatively quickly through the text, on page 11, he talks about the author translates Heidegger a bit unhelpfully here to talk about the four causes as a modes of occasioning. And it's difficult to think about, okay, what would be an occasioning? What I'll note here is this, that is to say that if there's a responsibility, one is meeting up with, one is coming in, these are coming into play. That's all that sort of occasioning is doing here. What I would begin to note, though, note the place metaphors that Heidegger uses. As antiquated as they are, these translations aren't too bad, but they are a bit Heideggerese. Bringing forth brings hither out of concealment, forth into unconcealment. This is being done because if he uses the metaphors of knowing and seeing, this brings him to an epistemological thought. Well, what is to be known about technology? Let's describe it endlessly. That doesn't get us to its way, how we are in relation to it. Right? And so Heidegger uses this place technology, metaphors, to talk about here, there, and movement around that, those locations, so as to really bring you into, how do I comport with regard to technology? What is my way with it? Something that's not conceptual, but again, very much, for lack of a better word, revealed through an experience. Right? The way in which the car is available to you, you have a way with it, you have a comportment to it that is pre-cognitive, that is pre-conceptual. That is, you don't have to have very good conceptual knowledge, thank goodness, about cars to drive them around. You simply have to have a way with it. And that's what Heidegger is getting at here. And so you would say, you have a way, you go forward in the car, and there's a way in which it's presence to you as a going forward, and so on and so on. And so it's not simply a way of knowing. Okay, he does borrow the Greek word aletheia, A-L-E-T-H-E-I-A. I'll often just say aletheia with the T-H, the normal English T-H sound. This is generally translated as deconcealing. Here it's translated as revealing. Try not to think of the Christian notion of revelation here, although it could help you in this sense, that there's something revealed out of what he says is oblivion, out of forgetfulness. One thing that's been rescued or deconcealed out of oblivion is the question of being. Here, the question concerning technologies has arisen. It's begun to shape what our world is. Now, revealing, he uses here to escape from the idea of truth as correctness. So normally we say we are subjects set off from the world, and truth is nothing other than having a correct representation in our mind of what is happening outside in the world. And so this is a way of splitting us off into a subject and object. Now, contemporary analytic philosophy and contemporary continental philosophy, there's been a lot of critiques of what is the correspondence theory of truth. So that's been critiqued on all across the philosophical spectrum. Although that's how we use the truth in the everyday sense. So when somebody says, "Oh, that's true," they usually mean something like, "I have an idea of it, and it matches other perceptions of the world." Okay. Heidegger's to say, look, in order to have a subject and object, making that claim in the first place about a set of objects, that which is revealed has to be revealed in a particular way. That's a bit confusing, but to say that I can set myself off from an object, there's a previous revealing or deconcealing of a whole relationship of myself to that object first. Another way of simply putting it is, I am driving my car, I have a compartment to it, before I ever begin to know or want to learn about it because it's going to break down. Okay? Or I have a way or no knowledge of chairs, a way or an experience with chairs or revealing with chairs that has to occur before I can ever separate it off from myself and say, oh, let's look at this, let's fix this, let's try to make it more comfortable or something like that. In other words, you have to have a relationship with these sets of objects before you ever make them into, quote-unquote, an object for your in order to survey it or to look at it in a particular way, to search it. In Being in Time, to put it simply, Heidegger argues, we don't really take notice of objects until they break. Before that, we have a certain way with them. We go forward with them. They become a piece of equipment. We don't have to even really conceptualize or think of them. They break, and at that moment, they become present to us. They become objects to us. We say, well, we have to fix this. And I think experientially that should be at least true to you, right? That you don't really pay attention much to anything until it breaks. Your car breaks down. Suddenly you notice, wow, I really need this car. I've really been driving it everywhere. And if it breaks down, that really affects me. Or your television breaks. You really don't. Before that, you never really care about what makes it work. Suddenly you're caring. On page 13, he talks about the Greek techne. From earliest times until Plato, this is on page 13, the second sentence of the main paragraph, from earliest times until Plato, the word techne is linked with the word episteme. Now, techne is where we get the English word technology. Episteme, in philosophy, you study epistemology. This is the word for knowledge. Now, Heidegger is going to argue, rightly, that these words are often used interchangeably for knowing. In fact, in Plato, they are used interchangeably. He's going to try and pin down different meanings, but they're used for knowing. In Aristotle, in particular in the sixth book of his Nicomachean Ethics and the Metaphysics, he's going to fix different meanings for these terms. But until Plato, perhaps after, the Greeks used these terms together. They didn't separate it off. They didn't say, I have knowledge, and then I have know-how. In French, in German, in Italian, in other languages, you separate these two types of knowing out, right? You separate out know-how, a certain word for knowledge, from what we might call street smarts or practical knowledge, from another type of knowledge, which would be a knowledge of facts. Okay. Both words, he goes on, are names for knowing in the widest sense. They mean to be entirely at home in something, to understand and to be an expert in it. Such knowing provides an opening up. Now, what does this mean? Again, we're talking about the how of something. How are we related to X, Y, or Z being? And here, it's opened up to us before we can ever know it in terms of an epistemology. Before we can ever describe it as an object, it must first open up to us in a particular way. We must have a relationship to it. So we have to. Something has to bring forth. Okay. Now, technology is a mode, he says lower on the page, of revealing. It is a mode of truth, then. It's a mode of something that happens. Okay. Now, obviously, where this gets difficult is, as he says on the bottom of page 13 onto 14, is what does this have to do with technology? Well, one, he's going to say that modern physics has become dependent upon technology. But two, he's going to quick order argue that, in fact, there's a type of thinking that goes with this technology, and there's a very technological thinking known as physics. That is, the world is ordered in a particular way. If you've ever taken physics class, being is reducible to number. Being is reducible to a set of models. and that's it. Anything that is outside of those models doesn't count. Now, if you're doing physics and making the planes that I get on and the cars that go in and so on run, then that is perfectly acceptable, obviously. But if, and this is not something that's necessarily the scientists fall to, we only make being out to be that which goes through numbers, then Heidegger thinks it's a really reductive of what being is. That is, the revealing that he's talking about, the know-how, the way of being, is not something that can really be brought into these calculations. Certainly not. So what is the difference between the older technology and modern technology? Well, he says, what is modern technology? This is on page 14, the middle paragraph. It, too, is revealing. Only when we allow our attention to rest on this fundamental characteristic does that which is new in modern technology show itself to us. Okay, so then he's going to talk about the difference between the way a tract of land looks to somebody in modern agriculture and that the way that agriculture looks, the way that tract of land looks to somebody in the Greek times. He's going to say, ultimately, that we set up, I think in the English sense, I'll just borrow this, that he uses the German word Stellt often here. That means to stand up, to set up here. But I think just think of, or setting in order, just think of the word set up in English. You set somebody up. You set them over against you. You make them guilty. You use them. Okay? And I think there's a setting up of nature here in that sense. We set them up. We set them out of the way. We take care of it. Heidegger's going to put this under the language of a certain challenging. He calls it, on page 16, a monstrousness. There he uses the example of the hydroelectric plant, which he says, quote, this is top of page 16, is set into the current of the Rhine. This is the Rhine River in Germany. It sets the Rhine to supplying its hydraulic pressure, which then sets the turbines turning. This turning sets those machines in motion, whose thrust sets going the electric current for which the long-distance power station and its network of cables are set up to dispatch electricity, and so on and so on. And he's going to say, this is very different from that which is revealed through a very different form of technology, the Rhine River as it was seen, I guess potential at least, by the Greeks. He says on the top of page 17, what kind of unconcealment, that is, what type of truth, what kind of revealing of the world, what is our relationship to being, is another way of putting it. What kind of unconcealment is it, then, that is peculiar to that which comes to stand forth through the setting upon that challenges? This is modern technology. So the Rhine River stands forth, we set upon it, and we challenge it. Right? So the word challenge here is not helpful, but it's not left to stand alone. Something has to be put upon it. It's not just to let be. We start harvesting it. Whatever is ordered about in this way has its own standing. We call it the standing reserve, Bestand. This is an important term here. He says, the word expresses something more and something more essential than mere stock. The name standing reserve assumes the rank of an inclusive rubric. And it goes down a little bit further. Whatever stands by in the sense of standing reserve no longer stands over against us as an object. We dominate it. It's part of our dominion. We act as sovereign creatures over the earth, and it is but a resource. So I think perhaps just think of standing reserve as a resource. This is, again, to oversimplify Heidegger a bit, but it's important to see that we take being itself to be present to hand, to able to be used at any, ready to hand indeed, as a piece of equipment, as something that can be, that should be mastered, and something that we should dominate. This is not an environmentalism as such, although it certainly lends itself to environmental type thinking. Why? Because environmentalists could be given over to a certain standing reserve of nature by saying, look, we have this precious resource, and you'll actually hear this language in a lot of Sierra Club ads, we have this precious natural resource, and we shouldn't let it be destroyed by industry. In other words, they're saying a more efficient use of nature would be for camping and so on, not for its destruction. Okay? So the problem isn't with technology as such, but with its use. So Heidegger's going to call this the end-framing, the Gestell, the way in which all of our ideas can be mapped onto a certain notion of efficiency, a certain notion of standing reserve, a certain notion of order in the universe. Okay? And so let's be very clear that this is why Heidegger is not going to argue against technology, but is going to want to question concerning the essence of technology. Now, as he notes on page 18, soon enough, of course, it's not just nature, or what gets called nature, is not just that is revealed as a standing reserve. No, indeed, man can indeed, as he writes on the top of page 18, conceive, fashion, and carry through this or that in one way or another. And going below, the current talk about human resources, he says in the middle of the page, about the supply of patients for a clinic, gives evidence of this. What is this? Well, it's his argument that man himself can be challenged, and human beings themselves can be made into an order. That is, that human beings can be made into a standing reserve. And anybody who's ever worked anywhere knows, because they've had to pass through human resources. And anytime you've ever felt like you were a number on a page, a mere statistic, merely treated as an object, you've been made into a standing reserve, a resource. And you were talked about in our economy wholly as something efficient. Is it worth paying you for the amount of labor that you produce? If not, you will be fired. You will be laid off. Those calculations are made every day. This is not to call this into question. Heidegger is not critiquing it as such. Yes, he's an old-fashioned, conservative, small-C German who is writing in 1949 and then in 54 is giving this final lecture, a version of this lecture. Yes, he is that. Is this a guy given over to skiing rather than, say, driving automobiles around the country? Yes. Is this somebody who seems to critique these things and does not have a taste for modern technology? Yes. But the question is not to ask about this or that technology. Again, it's to ask, what gives rise to these technologies? What gives rise to thinking of human beings and everything else as mere ideas about profit-making, as ideas about resources? Now, one way to go about this is to think that the Greeks and earlier people were somehow stupid. I actually find this a rather aggravating habit, and whenever I fall into it, I try to stop myself, that somehow the people who were in the Middle Ages thinking about God and then the Greeks and so on were somehow just more stupid. And if they only knew better, they would know they should have been doing A, B, or C. And that even the most stupid among us today are far, far brighter than anybody that you could pull forward in the Middle Ages. This is because we have a certain particular type of what thinking, a certain prejudice about what thinking is. And as Heidegger would argue, what we want to do is attempt to think why it is that we think that way. Why it is that we think in such a way that gives rise to the whole notion of human resource. It's not that the Greeks did not know how to build a bomb, or how to build a dam, or how to build the technologies that Heidegger mentions as emblematic of a certain challenging of being, a certain challenging that makes being into an order, makes it into a standing reserve. Indeed, they didn't have this expertise. But it's not just that. They wouldn't have even thought to do it. It wouldn't have occurred to them to even want this. That's what Heidegger's getting at. It's not that the whole technology was foreign to them, right? That they somehow just didn't have the tools, and if they had the tools, they would have had it. It's that they didn't invent it for another reason. It would never have occurred to them. They would never have wanted it. It would have just been suspicious and silly to them. That's what Heidegger's getting at. That's the importance of his essay, is to mark out that this is not something, quote-unquote, natural to us, that we don't want just more and more efficiency, that this is something that was born at a certain date in Western history, and perhaps, with what Heidegger would call the turning, with the precipitous moment that he'll mark in terms of the greatest danger, but perhaps the time of a certain saving. We can mark out what he calls a free relation to this technology in such a way that we can begin to perhaps have another destiny with regard to technology. That's ultimately where Heidegger is wanting to go with his entire essay. So he talks on page 18 about the difference between handiwork and that type of concealment, and the one that, as he says, challenges man into an ordering on page 19, one that puts man upon an order in relation to the real as a standing reserve. He then introduces on the bottom of page 19 the inframing, the Gestell. Okay. There's a good footnote on the bottom of the page noting what Heidegger is attempting to do there with the inframing and why the author has chosen that. In the beginning, when you first read this, do think of it as a frame. We're caught within a frame. We're caught within a certain ideology. But use this frame to throw it away. In other words, begin to think about how we're caught by this frame, how we're caught within it, how we can only think of technology and can think of being in this particular way, and then realize in the second step that the use of frames, the use of strategies, the use of models like this is extremely efficient, and it's also a manner of representative thinking that is a mark for Heidegger of the age. Okay, so you will throw the frame away after using it to sort of build to that that thought. Okay. He defines inframing on page 20, the bottom. The Gestell, or inframing, he says, means the gathering together of that setting upon which sets upon man, challenges him forth to reveal the real in the mode of ordering a standing reserve. Inframing means that way of revealing which holds sway in the essence of modern technology and which is itself nothing technological. The essence of technology is not technological. The essence of a chair is not a chair. If a certain way with technology, a certain revealing with technology, he's going to ultimately say, but it's not technological, right? Secondly, inframing means the gathering together of the setting upon, which sets upon man. In a word, it's the modern ideology. That's what that's what he means by the term. It sets upon us and therefore aligns, focuses, changes, controls our relationship to things in a technological, ordered way. That's what he's talking about there. And so on page 21, he'll describe the difference between modern and old technologies. And in framing, the unconcealment comes to pass in conformity with which the work of modern technology reveals the real as standing reserve. So in other words, being is revealed as a standing reserve for us in the modern age. We can't help but think of being as over and against us, as something that is we have dominion over something that is already ordered, and this something that is there for our use and utilization. Our science, as he notes on the bottom of page 21, as he says, entraps nature as a calculable coherence of forces. That's what physics is. Okay. Then he goes into thinking about, well, which came first, the chicken or the egg, mathematics, did it come before technology, or did technology give rise to the need for mathematics that would continue to expand? That doesn't sound like an important thinking. It is, but on the other hand, what's important for us is that underlying both physics, both this theoretical ordering of the world, and on the other hand, this technological, very practical ordering of the world that is taking place every day, environmentally and otherwise, both of them are underlined by this ideology. That comes first. You have to begin to think of the world as an ordered whole in order to begin to calculate it into the various pieces you find in physics, and to then really go out and break it up into those pieces, as we often do through technology. Okay. Turning over to page 25, he talks about freedom. He'd already talked about the notion of destiny. All that I want to say is this, in other words, in order to keep this simple, is that what Heidegger is saying here is it's not up to us to choose. You didn't choose whether to be within this inframing. You didn't choose to be thrown into the particular existence you have. You didn't choose to have the particular relationship to being that you have, or the relationship to technology. That is a historical fact. It has happened, and it is underway. It's not something you can constantly choose for or against. Sadhguru notes, I time it again in this essay, to choose against technology is often done in the name of another technology. It's more efficient. It's better to do this way because of this efficient value. And how, so we can't think of freedom with regard to this technology as simply choosing for or against it. No. What we need is this, what he calls a standing reserve, what we can just so call the space for critique of the very ideology underlying it. So this, where there's a certain destining, this is the word he uses, that goes through us. In other words, we tend to think of, well, we read this, then we'll choose to do something else. You can't. Right? Whatever way or mode of being you have, part of that is not, if you take it seriously at all, something that you can choose for or against. History works through you. Okay? And that way, history working through you does not open up for you this silly choice to suddenly jump outside of that historical trajectory. But this is not to give you no responsibility whatsoever. You are, of course, as operating through techne, operating through a certain revealing of that history, operating through a certain mode of relation to it. And that way, we can begin to open that up. And that's what the difference is between destiny and fate is for Heidegger on 25. Fate is there inevitably. Destiny means it's sort of the future set out for us on this trajectory. But it's one that need not be so. Okay, so we do have a certain destiny, but that's not an accomplished fact. So once we open ourselves up to this essence of technology, we can be taken, as what he says on top of page 26, into a freeing claim. It means claim there in sort of having a claim on our own existence. So as long as we are trapped in technological thinking, as long as we haven't opened up the essence of technology, we can't go at its root. We just continue hacking at the weeds, okay, to put it another way, and don't really get to what's the essence of the problem. It's here that he talks about, from Hoderlin's writing, where danger is, grows the saving power also. As he says on page 28, this is right above that quotation, the threat to man does not come in the first instance from the potentially lethal machines and apparatus of technology. Now let's pause there. You might think, well, in 1949, 1954, in our age, certainly there is quite a potentially lethal threat from technology. Heidegger's worried, though, that if everything becomes completely isolated under this ordering, including human beings, there'll be nothing left to save. So the greatest danger comes not from the technology itself. It's from the ideology, from the inframing that gives rise to that technology. The actual threat has already affected man in his essence. That is to say, we think of other human beings, in their essence, as orderable. Okay, we think we have a human nature that is the same, that is robotically reproduced in all of us, and that we're reducible ultimately to numbers, digits, to resources. The rule of inframing threatens man with the possibility that it could be denied to him to enter into a more original revealing and hence to experience the call of a more primal truth. That's ultimately the threat. That man's and human beings' relationship to being will be lost. That we no longer be thinking beings, that is, beings who can go beyond just calculating thought, but perhaps ultimately think that's our destiny and indeed our fate to only do that. So by opening up this distance, we can begin to open up the saving power that he's trying to talk about here. So this is not something that is about a certain knowledge, though, but it's about changing our way. One might even talk about habits or something like that. As he says on page 33, the coming to presence of technology threatens revealing, threatens it with the possibility that all revealing will be consumed in ordering, that everything will present itself only in unconcealment or unconcealedness of standing reserve. Again, he's simply saying there, in all that Heideggeries, we face the threat that the only revealing, the only truth left will be the one we find in almost the robotic, computer-type thinking of the standing reserve. We are all digits on a Microsoft Excel spreadsheet. Now, you realize how reductive it is if you saw all of your characteristics out on a spreadsheet, that you're completely orderable. You realize how reductive it is. You should realize how reductive that is of being itself, Heidegger is saying. And that's where everything is treated as a standing reserve. You're orderable. You're able to be put in terms of digits. And that's it. There's nothing beyond that. Okay? That is ultimately the ideology of a number of thinkers out there. Not Heidegger. Not others, though. Okay? And so Heidegger's trying to take us away from this precipice here in the question concerning technology. Now, where does this take us? As we get to the end of the essay, he certainly opened up for us, I think, the grave dangers that we face. And this podcast has gone on for some time, and perhaps I'll try to keep it shorter next time. It's a bit late when I'm recording this, so I tend to get much chattier because I'm afraid I'm not going over things. But where we get to at the end of this, the question concerning technology, is perhaps a standing relation to rethink a relationship to what we call technology. Not that we're going to get rid of technology, because as Heidegger says, technology is itself a type of revealing that happens in relationship to being. What does that mean? We are inextricably linked to technology in some way. The use of creating objects that itself make us. Right, that we have a relationship to, that become part of our world, that reveal the world in a particular way for us. That's not going to change. But what could change is all relationships become an ordering, a commanding, a sovereignty over the being that itself puts these objects in the world with full sovereignty, full control, full ordering over us, such that in the end, we all become human resources. We become ordered about by the beings that we created. And it's from here that I would say, watch Terminator 3, Terminator 4. No, don't watch Terminator 3. But watch the Terminator series for how, I guess, men are taken over by technology. In any case, I'll see you next time.